Life is a game, as the old adage goes. As a philosopher who is also a game designer, Ian Bogost hears it a lot. It's the easiest way for people to make polite conversation when they discover that he's interested in the creation, use, and meaning of a contemporary technological medium like games, as well as metaphysical questions like, what does it mean for something to exist? Well, life is a game, and so what exactly? In his book, Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games, Ian Bogost assures us that life isn't really a game and that he doesn't want to turn it into one. He believes reality is all right as it is, and it's just as hard to see what it is through the lenses of game design and philosophy and psychology, anthropology, science, art, design, entertainment, computing, and literature. He offers a perspective of how to live in a world far bigger than our bodies, minds, hopes, and dreams, and how to do it with some pleasure and gratitude. Ian Bogost is Distinguished Chair in Media Studies and a Professor of Interactive Computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology. The new book is Play Anything, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Ian Bogost to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
What brought you to this idea of ultimately exploring these ideas of limits and yes, our human boredom and what games can do in all of this?
Right. So I've been making and studying and looking at the history of games for many years now, and I've made all sorts of strange games about improbable topics like tort reform and suburban errands and things like that. And it was always, you know, striking to me that there's something about games that had lessons for the world. And part of my prior work was about like the way that games have uses in education and in politics and that sort of thing. That's one kind of world. Like rather than just being used for entertainment, we can use this media for newsmaking and for education and that kind of stuff. But something was still kind of nagging at me that any game or really anything that's playable, right? Like guitars are playable and maybe dishwashers are also playable. There was kind of something to learn there. And at the same time, as a programmer, as a creator, I work with these highly constrained systems. You know, like I write games for the old 1977 Atari, which has 128 bytes of RAM and kind of can't do anything. And some of the pleasure of that experience is not that it can't do anything, but submitting yourself to the fact that it's such a simple, constrained system. So, you know, those were some of the building blocks. And what I realized, and kind of what the book is grounded on, is the idea that this experience of play is in anything, so long as you know how to and you're willing to find and work with the natural constraints and limitations that are built into things. And those things could be, you know, lawns or dishwashers or personal relationships or anything whatsoever once you're kind of looking at them in the right way.
You make a point in the book to say that just those concepts of play and fun, we may think we understand them, but you don't believe that we fully understand them.
Yeah, these are words, play and fun. They're words that we use all the time without really knowing what we mean. You know, like how are you? I'm fine. You don't really mean to say how are you. It's just a kind of functional act, you know? And play and fun in particular are like this. You know, we think play is like the opposite of work most often. We have to do the things that we have to do, and then play is what we get to do. We think play is this experience of freedom where we get to do whatever we want. And we tend to think play is an experience that we derive from ourselves. You know, you figure out kind of what to do, and then you're acting playfully, even to the point that, you know, maybe you're doing too much play, like you tell your kid don't play with your food or something like that. And fun, you know, we think of as enjoyment or as pleasure. But to me, I just kind of flip those on their head. You know, play isn't in us, and it's certainly not the opposite of work if it can be found in anything. It's just that process of working with things to find out how they operate and what you can do with them. So one way of thinking about this new concept of play that I'm suggesting is the kind of play that's in like a mechanism, like a steering column, you know, and there's a little bit of play through which the wheel has to turn before it begins engaging. That's maybe a better metaphor. So, and if you think of play as being in stuff, like there's play in things, there's play in the guitar, and playing the guitar doesn't mean doing whatever you want with it, but holding its fretboard and strumming its strings in a particular way, then you have to learn to attend to and sort of understand the natural limitations in these things and then figure out how to work with them, figure out what they can do. And you know, that idea of working is like working something like a woodworker works wood or like a dancer works the floor rather than the kind of laborious work that we think of. Yeah, fun is just the experience of discovering something new when you're engaged in that process of play. So that feeling of novelty, of discovery, especially in the context of something very familiar, like when you've done something over and over and over and over again, and yet still there's something that you haven't seen before, that's what fun is.
This is another definitional question, and that is, we may know paranoia. You talk about ironoia. Give us a sense of what that is and how you came to coin this term.
Right. So this is one of the important concepts in the book. It's kind of the antagonist of the book, irony, and the associated malady or sickness that comes from suffering from irony all the time, which I call ironoia, which it's exactly as you said, there's this kind of parallel to paranoia. So paranoia tends to be the fear or the mistrust of people. You know, someone is out there to get me, and they're watching me, and they're gonna know what I'm doing and somehow disrupt my intentions. And ironoia is the mistrust of things. And you know, we live in this era where we have enormous anxiety and fear, and some of it's justified. You know, our economic conditions, our political conditions. It's become harder and harder and harder to live an ordinary life. So it's not entirely unreasonable that we would have this fear. But the way that we express it is by holding almost anything at arm's length, you know, for fear that it'll disappoint us. And some of these things can be just ordinary things even. It's not just your mortgage or your marriage or something. Like, you know, you go to the supermarket and there's a million ketchups to choose from, and how do you pick? And so that tendency to ironize, to sort of sneer and wink at things, you know, whether by, you know, posting a picture of them on the internet or simply by saying, oh, you know, this couldn't possibly satisfy me, and so therefore I'll kind of just reject it and wait until something better comes along. That tendency is just all over the place. It's everywhere. And the relationship between irony and ironoia and play is that, you know, play demands this kind of engagement with stuff, this embrace of objects of any kind or people or things or situations, and treating them for exactly what they are, and then figuring out what their limitations are and working within those limitations to produce new kinds of meaning. And those new kinds of meaning are found in the stuff rather than in your head. It kind of releases you from the burden of always having to come up with meaning inside your head. And so, you know, that's the flip side of the coin. You know, the cure to irony is play, and recognizing that we kind of live under this sickness of ironoia is a process of, you know, stopping ourselves really when we find ourselves kind of sneering or mistrusting the entities with which we're surrounded, and then kind of saying, okay, well, hang on, like, what's going on here? How does this thing work? What can I do with it? And how can I find pleasure and meaning even in the absurdity of manipulating it? You know, it could be your lawn or your dishwasher or your toaster, which you don't normally think of as these fonts of meaning. But for me, if we can find that meaning in little tiny experiences all day, every day, then that's much more effective than, you know, waiting for some momentous occasion to come along.
So let us go back to the catchabile for a moment, if we can. So if we tend to fear everything and we keep it at a distance, you make the point in the book, we will most always fail because there's just too much. There's too much abundance to hold everything back. So does
right.
that mean that we have to try a new catch-up?
You don't have to try a new ketchup. I think the trick is, you know, in treating even that stupid experience of buying ketchup as something of potential value. You know, and the way that you can ironize ketchup, of course, is either by, you know, thinking yourself above the very concept of ketchup, right? Or perhaps by adopting, you know, some sort of artisanal affectation that your ketchup only comes from locally grown tomatoes that you fashion yourself or that, you know, you purchase from the mustachioed fellow down the block. And the truth is that either of those choices, you know, choosing not to eat ketchup or kind of making a fancy ketchup, those are interesting choices. And, you know, you might choose one day and one another, and they have meaning and value in them. You know, the delightful sickly sweetness of packaged supermarket ketchup is a certain kind of pleasure, and so is making your own ketchup. That's also a certain kind of pleasure. And so is buying a new ketchup every time you go to the store to try them all out. And, you know, this may seem like what's the point of this, right? Like, really, this is how we're going to improve our lives is by thinking about our ketchup purchases more deliberately. But when you reflect on all of those small, tiny, individual experiences that we have every day, they are just so frequent that that's where that idea of surplus comes in. You know, if we can't make those tiny experiences meaningful, then we're really sunk.
You talk in the book about novelty and say that fun isn't pleasure, it is novelty. And that goes back, that brings that whole idea of what is fun and what we should get out of it. What do we consider to be fun, and how do we know that we're actually having fun?
Yeah, you know, one exercise you can try is the next time you find yourself saying the word fun or hear someone saying it, kind of stop yourself and ask, wait, you know, what's going on here? So, you know, one of the examples in the book that I use is, you know, you come home from a night out, or your roommate or your significant other comes home, and you're like, oh, how was, you know, maybe it's beers after work or whatever. How was it? How was your evening? Oh, it was fun. You know, like, what does that mean? What is going on there? Because it's not exactly enjoyment. You know, like, there's a lot of different emotions that are all wrapped up and kind of winding down after the day and visiting with friends, and maybe you're hanging out with some coworkers you like and some that you don't. It's rather that in that familiarity, you know, you're at the same bar with the same hot wings and the same people, and you have kind of the same conversations about the same workplace traumas and challenges. Everything is kind of the same, but nevertheless, there's still something new. You know, someone had a new story to tell, or, you know, they have an update on their situation at home, or you know, they made a very small bit of progress on a personal project or something at work, or they made you feel better, or maybe made you feel worse even. That discovery of novelty in familiarity is what I think we're getting at when we say things are fun. It's that we've discovered something in the world, and that thing that was in the world was there waiting for us. It wasn't that we had to make it. And there's that enormous pleasure in having a respect for it, you know, looking at that moment or that thing and realizing, wow, that's out there. You know, the universe is so much bigger than I am, and nevertheless, I can observe and experience parts of it anew.
You talk in the book a lot about creativity and the history of creativity. What ultimately do you think we can learn from that long journey?
The most important lesson from the history of creativity is that creativity doesn't come from the blank page. You know, we have this romantic notion of what it means to be creative, and it's like you wake up in the morning and lightning strikes, and somehow you get these ideas, and you open your notebook or your word processor, or bring out your canvas, or open your programming interface, whatever it is that you do, and then you kind of get started, and those ideas spill out onto the page, and the creation is made, right? But in fact, creativity is always been working within constraints that pre-exist you, that are given before you. And you know, the a musical instrument isn't a bad idea, a bad example of a kind of way of seeing this. You pick up the guitar, or you sit down at the piano, and what's meaningfully creative about making music or playing music isn't sort of using that instrument in a new way. Like, it's not creative to take the guitar and bash it against the wall in that moment. Rather to sort of, I've got these several chords, and those chords they're the chords that I know. What kind of songs can I make with the chords that I know? Oh, it turns out that many, many, many songs, in fact, most pop songs are made from like four chords or so. Or if you go back into ancient history, the history of poetry and epic in ancient Greece and Rome were built on these very specific structures of meter, and they had these kind of mnemonics to remember the names of characters and how to describe them in order that they could recite these very, very long poems from memory, or kind of reconstruct them from memory. Or, you know, when you work, I program computers sometimes, and when you're working with a machine like that, you're always working under the technical limitations of the apparatus. You know, how much memory or storage does it have, or what is the user supposed to do? So creativity isn't a process of kind of allowing your inner genius to emerge, but rather recognizing the structures of the world that already exist, and then expressing something new within those structures.
Ultimately, you hope we get what out of the book?
I hope it makes ordinary life more tolerable and more meaningful.
That's a lot.
It is a lot, and you know, it's also hard to overcome the sense that many people have that play and games are just, you know, these activities that are off the books. You know, you're not supposed to be doing that kind of work. You're supposed to be doing real work, or it's for kids or something like that. But I think there's something in play and something in fun that's at the very foundation of meaning of all kinds.
The name of the book is Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games. The book is published by Basic Books. Ian Bogus, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Play Anything. It's published by Basic Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.